Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Bill Chadwick. He's got a new CD out of previously unreleased demos, mostly recorded in the mid and late 1960s. And these are things that he had been signed to some publishing deals and recorded these, hoping to get them recorded. He did have songs recorded by a bunch of artists. He's a guy who was born in L.A., spent some time in the folk world, and in his early 20s, as the pop scene was kind of sweeping LA, he got swept up in that. He sang on some Donovan records. He made the vest that Jimi Hendrix wore at Woodstock. He's a guy who sort of crossed paths with all these different interesting folks. He is mostly, I think, known for being the fifth monkey. And he earned that title by appearing in some episodes, touring as their lighting director, playing on some Monkees records, helping to produce some Monkees sessions, and writing a bunch of songs that they covered throughout their career. So, super interesting guy, and did some acting. He's done a lot of interesting things. But today we're here mostly talking about, like I said, this new collection of demos that has just been released. So enjoy this. It's me and my chat with Bill Chadwick about the new CD, Yesterday's Songs. There is Yesterday's Song. It's the lead-off track. It's the title track from Bill Chadwick, Yesterday's Songs, 1964 to 1973, Lost Demos, and Bill joins us. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice. These are real interesting demos. So many of them sound like hit songs. They're sort of all sort of tight, concise little pop songs. So what was the deal? You guys would go in and cut these in a few hours or in an evening? What was the time frame on getting a demo like these done?
Well, basically, I'd go in for a 3 or 4 hour time slot and pop in as much as I could. During most of the early part of these songs were things that were when I was signed up to MCA, and I did a lot of stuff recording at Gold Star there. That's where I met, by accident, Eddie Ho.
Eddie Ho, who was studio drummer, who played on a bunch of Monkey stuff. So you were signed to MCA, and the idea is that you would write some songs, cut these demos, and they would try to get these demos placed with contemporary recording acts. Was that sort of the plan?
Yeah, right. And they got a few, but they didn't do too well by me. And I jumped away from them and went to Gold Gems.
Gotcha. So for, I don't know, 50 years or so, you have kept, were they acetates? Were they cassette tapes? What medium did you, reel-to-reel tapes?
Well, in the old days, you'd go in there and they, at the end of a session, they'd cut a copy of the off of the tape onto a shellac, and I still had all the shellacs.
And are these 7 inches or 10 inches?
They were both. Some are 7 and some are 10s.
And so that's what this new CD is mastered off of, these old shellac acetates.
Right.
That is incredible. That's incredible. So let's go back to the beginning for a minute. I believe you were born in Los Angeles, 1943. Is that right?
Actually, Santa Monica in 1942.
Okay, close. And what did your folks do?
My mother, even before I was born, she was born in 1905. She was a waitress in initially when they came out to California at a place called the Brown Derby, which is where all of the movie stars would come to for their luncheons and stuff. My father was a real fine carpenter, and he was born in 1898.
And so tell me when rock and roll sort of hit your ear.
Oh, the 1950s. Up until that, just about everything I'd ever heard was country and western music.
Yeah, I was kind of listening to your songs, and I thought, like, it's interesting because you were, in your early 20s when you recorded a lot of these demos, and I was thinking, where did this style of music come from? Because for my generation, when I turned on the radio, I had so much there to start with. But, you know, I had a roadmap. People my age had a roadmap, but you had a totally different roadmap, right? Your parents were listening to music that sounds nothing like the music you were making. So can you put your finger on where this sort of germ of these kind of pop songs, or how it turned from country and Western to Elvis to 60s pop music?
You know, it just kind of fell that way. I was really into folk music for a lot. That was kind of an interim from going from country music to folk music, and then playing in little folk clubs around the Western Seaboard, and then also in Greenwich Village. It just seemed like there were just always new facets of music that were floating into my head, and I would grab a little bit here and a little bit there, and it became what I made.
The first song I could find of yours, I'm sure there are probably some that predate this, was an Ed Ames cut called Mingo, the Man with the Bullwhip, from 1965. So I'm curious, were songs like that written to order? Was the word put out, you know, Ed Ames is looking for dramatic kind of songs? Or how were songs like that written, and then how were they placed with guys like Ed Ames?
Well, I'll tell you, that was really a crazy one. I was working with Randy Sparks in a club that he had called Ledbetter's in West Hollywood. He had been the owner of the New Christy Minstrels, and while working there for Randy Sparks, a guy named Barry Friedman, who was pretty well known on the Western scene, Barry came up to me one day and said, "Hey, look at this, the people at this particular motion picture company, I think it was Fox, they're looking for somebody to write a song for this upcoming series that they're doing with this Ed Ames, to take the place of his character, this Indian character, in his own show from the Daniel Boone show. And they really want somebody that's, you know, young and fresh on this." And I said, "Well, fine, I'll go ahead." And so I took him and my brother, John, and we went up to Fox, and they told us basically what they wanted. And my brother and I sat down and wrote it in about, 45 minutes or something, after looking at their cheat sheets about where they wanted to go with it. And I sat down in the back lot with them and sang it one time. They said, "This is really good, but, you know, can you maybe jazz it up a little bit?" And so I said, "Sure." I went out in the back lot again and started playing and just said the same song, except sang it louder. And they said, "That's perfect. That's what we want." And that night we were in the studio, and bingo. A week or so later, it was on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Yeah, unfortunately, they never got through with the series, so it didn't do as well as it could have. But it sold a lot of records over the years, and it was on one of his albums, and it was very, a big deal.
So I'm very curious into what the mood was pre-Beatles, and how, you know, I have this theory that the Beatles sort of changed everything. I know in some ways, like literally guys like Roger McGuinn sort of moved from folk into more rock. Is that really what happened from your point of view? Was there a palpable change in Los Angeles in the approach?
Definitely. And there was a lot of ego things going around there, too.
Like what?
Like David Crosby, and as you just mentioned, one of the other birds. They were just like the pushiest guys in the town, but they were making good music, and that's what counted.
So 1965 casting starts for the Monkees. What was the first inkling that you heard that this was going on?
Well, that same day that just about everybody else that showed up for the auditions did, it showed up in Variety magazine and a couple of other places. And there's another place where being around Randy Sparks' office came in handy, because a notation about it came into there. And we got the information. A bunch of us jumped in a car and headed out to the auditions.
So they just let anybody, I think a few hundred folks showed up. Did they really just let anybody who wanted to audition?
Oh, yeah, that was it. You know, it was a, you know, a very slight set of standards that they put up, and you either fit in there or you didn't. And my screen test and stuff lasted for months and months and months. I was in the Army Reserves at the time, and they'd have me flying back and forth to go to these additional meetings with them. As it came down to it, I was the last one cut.
Oh, so you literally were the fifth monkey. What did they have you do during the auditions?
Oh, sit down and play a song, or do a couple of, do a song with Mike, or do a song with Davey in an office someplace to introduce us and see how we function together. And you know, they were really trying their best to put something together that was going to work.
And was the feeling on the street that this was going to be a cool thing, or did it seem like a commercial thing that was not going to be cool, at least before it actually happened? What was the feeling?
It depended on which side of the street you were on, I think. You know, if you were in Vito Lido's, which was a place where the Doors would play and things like that, they didn't want to even admit that there was something called the Monkees. You go into the Troubadour, and there were guys that think, oh, yeah, that's cool, because the Association were coming together there, too, at the same time as the Monkees were. In fact, I had been asked to join the Association, but I had so many other things going at the time that I just pulled away from it. Big mistake. I was offered once, towards the end of the Monkees, I was offered an opportunity to produce all the stuff from the Partridge Family. And I said, no, I'm tired of the soft stuff. I want to get into heavier music. And I walked away from that. Big mistake. And then came the Cowstills, and I was offered the same situation. And I said, no, big mistake. But, you know, when you're young and you've got things on your mind, ways you want to go, sometimes you just go those ways, and it's not always the right way.
Yeah. Well, like you said, you're the last guy cut in the Monkees auditions, and you end up participating in a lot of Monkees recordings, playing, singing, writing a bunch of songs with them. There's a very interesting dynamic in the Monkees where they start off having very little participation in their own recordings, right? Some of them they only sing on, and not even all of them. And then as the group progresses, as the history progresses, they're much more in charge of picking the songs and playing on their own stuff and producing their own recordings. So tell me, is it just from your friendship with Mike Nesmith, or was there some other way that you were sort of always around that scene?
Yeah, there was. And part of it's Bob Rafelson. Because Bob and I, they became very good friends during the auditions, and he opened an awful lot of doors for me. I mean, lots of work as on different TV shows and stuff. You know, pop in here, pop in there, make a few extra bucks so you can keep food on the table while we're trying to get something good happening for you.
Were you around for the Sunset Strip riots?
Yes, I was.
Tell people, I don't think everybody remembers that event. Tell just briefly, recap what happened and what your part was.
It was so crazy. There was what really brought on the, what most people call the riot on the Sunset Strip. It was a riot. And it was scary out there. We had the highway patrol out there and just thousands and thousands of people just surrounding, filling the streets, and state police, county police, city police were just swarming the place, and nothing but guns and clubs. It was ridiculous, and it all came about a little nightclub at the end of top end of Crescent Heights. Right at Sunset Boulevard, they wanted to shut down this club because they thought it was bringing in too many young people and it was going to cause problems. And they wanted to shut the place down, so they determined they were going to do it this night. Well, everybody and every young person in the Hollywood, Los Angeles area showed up there to say, no, 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 this isn't going to happen. Well, it did happen, but it put a lot of people in the hospital and a lot of gun firing and a lot of clubbing, and it was pretty ugly.
What was the upshot? Were people horrified at the police, or were they horrified at the teenagers? What was the upshot?
Well, the teenagers were up in arms. They were they'd had it. Think of Steve Stills' song, What a Field Day for the Heat, 1,000 people in the street. Well, there were more than 1,000. Believe me, because I was there. Because I only had to walk about 5 or 6 blocks to get there. Yeah. Neil Young lived 2 doors down from me, and Davey lived about 4 blocks from me, and all right around Sunset Boulevard, between Sunset Boulevard and Santa Monica Boulevard, between Delaney Drive and Crescent Heights, just a little block, blockage of where it's happening.
So during all this time, you are, like we said earlier, contributing music to Monkees Records, Zorin Zam on 68, The Birds, Bees, and the Monkees, and songs from The Monkees Present, and songs on Instant Replay. And one of the things I notice is how, in such a short time, The Monkees put out so much music. Was it that they were, you said earlier that songs kind of came much quicker back then, but were they just working 24 hours a day to get the TV show and the touring and the records done?
You got it, exactly. We were working in the studio at night, recording from 6 o'clock in the morning to be on set for the shows. I was on, participating in a couple of the shows, was photographing at a lot of the other shows, and doing bit parts in different things like Bewitched and The Flying Nun and other little shows like that.
Mm.
It was busy day, busy people, but you had to stay in the, keep yourself in the limelight enough to continue working and having the money flowing in.
So I'm curious, because The Monkees' music has ebbed and flowed over the past 50-plus years, the show comes back, and the show's bigger than ever, and the band tours, and so has this been a constant sort of helper to your income for, is this like a little bit of a nest egg for you, something you can always rely on, that work you did for Monkees?
Not really, because there's not that much money that came in on the recording stuff that makes a significant difference in my lifestyle.
Gotcha. So maybe you get to go take yourself out to dinner a couple times a year, but not much more than that?
Well, maybe a little bit more than that some years, but some years I might get a Coca-Cola.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, throughout the, 50-some-odd years, there were good years and bad years.
Yeah.
And the bad years were horrendously bad, and the good years were really good, but you didn't get paid what you were supposed to because of all the stuff that would go through the companies that were supposedly doing their best for you.
Yes. I mean, there's very few people I've interviewed who felt that they got 100% of what they deserve. Yeah. Well, let's go back to the demos, which is why we're talking to Bill Chadwick today. The new CD is called Yesterday's Songs. You can go to billchadwick.net to order a copy. And these are demos recorded between 1964 and 1973 that have been remastered and are now together on this one CD. So very interesting. I'm curious, that were these songs things that were like burning a hole in your soul, or were most of them things like we talked about earlier with Ed Ames, things that were written for a specific something that a producer or a band was looking for?
Well, only a couple of times. I think for You and I was something they needed a song, and we put it together. We made it happen. The thing with Ed Ames was similar. But other than that, it was things that usually just came out of my mind.
Am I right that you play rhythm guitar on Pleasant Valley Sunday?
Yeah.
And was that, did you guys just sit there going, oh, this is going to be a giant hit? Did everybody know?
No, you never know.
Let's talk about, you mentioned earlier that band called The New Society, and there's a song, that song of you that they that you co-wrote with your brother that they did, and you're right that it is sort of like an association, maybe meets the Byrds or something, and that band was sort of put together, you know, for Randy Sparks. It is interesting how the record company worked that way, that there were so many things that started with the record company. They didn't, you know, they weren't organic bands. Another one I'm wondering about is this group called the Rainy Day Friends that covered one of your songs, Through My Painted Window. Was that a real band?
I have no idea, to be honest with you. I didn't even know the group had recorded it for about 4 or 5 years later.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, I do wonder about, you know, these records by these kind of bands that no one's heard of, like, were they all released with the ambition of making hit records? You know, it's hard to know how the record business even worked back then. 1969, I know Mike Nesmith produced a 45 on you that came out on Dot Records, Talking to the Wall, a song that he ended up doing a version of himself. So again, like, what is the ambition of a 45 like that? It was like, we'll just put it out there and see what happens. Maybe we'll have a hit on our hands.
Well, yeah, that's about what it was. And, the thing is, they would do that on these labels, but wouldn't promote them, and so they didn't really go anyplace. If they had a group that was already popular, then bingo, they got a good chance. But if they take the songwriter who doesn't really have a name as an artist or isn't being promoted well enough to get the an important name as an artist, then you're kind of screwed.
Yeah, there are just so many records. The sheer number of records that was put out in that time period out of Los Angeles is a little bit mind-boggling. Yeah, and
they felt like rain. It really did.
Yeah, that's great. Well, in addition to music, you've done fine art, and you appeared in, like, I read that you were in the Rockford Files and Chips. So clearly, you stayed in L.A. and sort of did all kinds of things. What other work did you do post Monkees?
Well, I outside of being music, I spent 35 years doing restoration of Tiffany lamps and windows for the Smithsonian, Metropolitan Museum, stuff like that. Oh, a lot of things. I just bounced around from one thing to another. I like to work with my hands. I guess you could call me an artist, but I love to create.
And do you still pick up the guitar? Do you still write music? Do you still play music?
Well, I can turn around and look behind me, and there's, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 guitars and one bass.
Why was now the time that you finally got these lost demos on this new CD? Why now?
Well, because, I mean, it's really, I guess it's egotistical, but I'm getting pretty well up into my years, and I just didn't want to see this stuff lost.
Folks can go to BillChadwick.net to get one of the copies of Yesterday's Songs, 1964-73, Lost Demos. Well, thanks for visiting with us. I so appreciate you taking some time for us, and it's such an interesting story, and it is interesting to get the point of view of somebody who was there but didn't have the spotlight sort of in their eyes blinding them, so you were still sort of able to see what was going on.
Yeah, it was a great advantage sometimes to be on the outside instead of on the inside.
Well, best of luck with the CD, and let's hear right now from Bill Chadwick.